and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Welcome to another episode of Lunching with Lawyers. Abe Ahrens is the principal at Ahrens Legal Solutions, a firm he established 2 years ago. He has over 20 years' experience in personal injuries and family law. Welcome, Abe, to Lunching with Lawyers on this very wet evening in Brisbane.
Evening, Loretta.
Let's launch straight into it. You went to St. Joseph's in Brisbane to school. That's an all-boys school in Brisbane, isn't it?
That's right. I went, also known as Gregory Terrace. And my parents are Catholic, and my sister had gone to All Hallows. So naturally I went to the brother school in Brisbane. And so I went there from grade 5 to grade 12. And I still have a very, you know, had a good schooling, and I still have a very close network of friends from Terrace.
And do you think that was one of the benefits of going to a single sex school, the friendships that you made, or what were like when you reflect back and think about it, especially as you have your own children? Do you think that was a great experience, or do you think a mixed gendered school is possibly better?
I'd have to say I think a mixed gender school would probably be better from a social point of view. And in fact, I've decided that with my children's mother that our children will go to a co-ed school. I just think they'll benefit from that and from a social point of view.
But that's the only reason.
That's the only reason. Yeah.
But academically, perhaps a single sex school might be better.
Academically, I'm not necessarily sure. I certainly benefited from my time at Gregory Terrace academically, and I guess with my socially with my network of friends. But I still think there's a good opportunity academically co-ed schools, and that's the primary reason behind my children going to a co-ed school will be, I think, socially they'll develop better.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that, having gone to a co-ed school. So after you finished school, did you go straight to university?
I did. I didn't quite get the OP that was needed to get into law. I felt just agonisingly short. So I went and did a year of arts at the University of Queensland, which was, I think, probably a good thing because it enabled me to sort of get that year of partying out of my system, perhaps. And having come from an all-boys school, suddenly you're thrust into an environment of, you know, girls as well. So I suppose, you know, I'm grateful for that. For that year, and I did also learn some great things while I was in doing that year of arts. It really was the stepping stone to doing law, and probably maturity wise, I probably was a little bit more mature the next year when I was ready to get cracking into law.
So, the interesting question, it looks to me, or it sounds to me, like you actually wanted to be a lawyer from the start.
Yes, well, the simple answer is legal studies was the only thing I was good at school. I wasn't great at maths. I was good at history and English, but I probably excelled at legal studies. And it was just immediately grabbed my interest over you know, chemistries and physics and biology and maths or computers. So that's how I fell into the law, and that's where I've been for the last 20 years.
And Abe, you are a very interesting person in that way, because most of the people that I speak to, law was the last thing on their mind.
I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing. But yeah, that's how I fell into it. It's the only thing I excelled at school.
So even though you partied a bit in your first year at UQ, you obviously got the marks to be able to transfer to a law degree.
Yes.
And why did you choose then the University of Technology?
I chose QUT because I had heard that their facilities were technologically more advanced than the University of Queensland. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I thought that would be a benefit to me, particularly going forward. I knew that the law would evolve, and I'd heard that the lecture theatres at QUT were better in terms of technology wise. Mm. And so I decided that I thought that was probably a good reason to go to QUT, that it was, I guess it was really was the university for the real world. It was taking steps forward in with its technology, making studying easier and that. So that was the main reason. The other reason was it meant I only had to get one bus from Mount Crosby and I didn't have to change at Indooroopilly and get a second bus. I just could get one bus. And as a result, I met a couple of really good friends that happened to get on the same bus at Kenmore on the way to uni and that did law. And so then that's how my university group started, was basically based on people who lived in the same area or on the same bus line as me and were going to QUT. And so I developed close friendships with people that way as well.
And do you think it was borne out that QUT was more technologically advanced than the other law schools at the time?
I think so. They certainly advertised it very well. And University of Queensland's lecture theatres, I just remember, they were dull, they were hot, but QUTs were they were very modern, you know.
And airy and in the city.
and in the city, yeah, that's right, exactly.
So after law school, though, you didn't go and do your practical legal training, which would have been available. You actually went and did a 2 years article program. Why did you decide to do that rather than the practical legal training?
There were two main reasons. The first is I wanted to earn an income, and the second is I guess I just wanted to have that experience of having a principal guiding me, an opportunity to divest into many areas of law and see what I really liked, because I'd always wanted to be a criminal lawyer. So I decided to take my articles of clerkship at a suburban firm that did all areas of practice. The principal did all areas of practice. So jack of all trades, master of none to start with. And that's how I just wanted to, I guess that's how I wanted to introduce myself to my legal career, was to, you know, get that diversity in practice. And then I could specialise once I thought I was ready.
So was that with Peter Williams?
That was with Peter Williams at Mount Gravatt.
And how did you get that position?
Oh, I just recall looking around for articles at various firms. I applied for one ultimately at McNamara's, where I ended up in 2012 anyway. And I actually was offered the job without an interview, but I knocked it back because I'd been offered a job with Peter at Mount Gravatt, and I saw that as closer to the city. So I decided to take that opportunity to then... You know, I felt that,
yeah,
I felt it was just closer to the city, that and whereas the other articles of clerkship at McNamara's at the time was at the Gatton office. But interestingly, the bloke who then got offered the job after me became a partner of McNamara's. So, you know, that my stepping stone to partnership probably would have been quicker had I gone to McNamara's. But when I look back now, I don't regret the decision of going to work with Peter. And he's a very good lawyer, and I got all that diversity. I'm not sure I would have got that at McNamara's. I think I would have been pigeonholed very early into personal injury law. And I didn't, as I said, I initially wanted to be a criminal lawyer, and I knew I would perhaps get that opportunity. Well, I knew I was going to get that opportunity with Peter. So
one of the things I think with working with a sole practitioner or a smaller firm is that as an article clerk, you're more likely to get more exposure to clients and legal practice. Do you think so?
Oh, absolutely. I got to meet all the new clients that came to see Peter, because he would say, well, Abe's going to assist me with your matter.
Mm.
And it was, as I said, a diverse range, everything from criminal law to personal injury, conveyancing, family law. I remember doing a passing off action against a company and getting an injunction in the Supreme Court for a company that was passing off as our client, and so I got
that would have been really exciting.
Oh, I know. I was actually got a great outcome for the client who kept coming back to the firm to Peter's firm as well, and I remember that case vividly.
Was it stressful?
No, the client actually made me feel very relaxed, even though he knew I was only young, and I had briefed experienced counsel in commercial litigation. I think it was Douglas Campbell, who's now a senior counsel, Queen's counsel. So I felt as though, I just felt the client, trusted me and my abilities, and in the end we got the result that he wanted, and he was very happy, and yes, he brought other matters to the firm and conveyancing and stuff like that. So I know my principal was really happy.
But you didn't become a criminal lawyer, so what happened?
No, so I did. So the story behind that is I got asked to do an appearance in a magistrate's court for a lady who'd been charged with stealing from her employer. She'd been stealing money from the employer's a draw and taking cash, and I just didn't like I knew that the client was lying, and I felt as and I knew my duty to the court. I didn't feel comfortable in the setting of the of doing criminal law. I had done traffic matters as well, which would, mainly pleas and, with people who've been accumulated too many points, or DUIs in particular. But it just didn't feel right for me. It just wasn't my area. And I even though it had been glamorized by university, it was far from it once I eventually got into practice. So I decided that it wasn't for me. And at university, I'd never really had an interest in tort law. But the more and more I got into some personal injury matters that we had, I really was enjoying helping people who were at sometimes in a really bad way from serious injuries, and or alternatively people who had gone through difficult separations and had, issues with seeing their children or property matters they wanted assistance with getting resolved. And I started to feel a bit more of a connection with the client. I guess I'm a bit more social. And those areas of practice really give you that. You get to really socialise with the clients in terms of I don't mean going out with the clients. I mean you're getting that constant interaction. Yeah, and building a relationship.
And I think that's really important. And also you can feel that you're on the side of good. And sometimes in other areas of practice you may not feel that you're on that side. I think it would be very difficult to act as a debt collector or the like, because often those things would play on your mind as to, even though it is possible to go to actually say, well, to have that justification in your mind as to what is moral, it is still something that's, you do want to act for people who you think are deserving, even though sometimes they may not be, even in the areas of civil law, I suspect.
Yes, you do come across some people who've, yeah, they get caught on video doing things that they said they couldn't do, and you've got to face the difficulties and challenges with those claims, particularly when you're doing them on a no-win, no-fee basis. But I still, overwhelmingly, most people are genuine clients who are going through a tough time, and I think I resonate with that. Right. And enjoy trying to, as best I can, help them get back on their feet, and hopefully do that as you know, quickly as possible, and so efficiently as possible for them.
And I also think one of the things that I've reflected on in my legal practice is, because I do a lot of work with people who are unable to afford to pay their loans, and in all my years of practice, there would have only been a couple that have come to me and said, I don't want to pay this. Most people come seeking help because they can't pay. So again, that most people are good and are quite genuine in what they're saying has happened to them, particularly in those sorts of areas where we're helping defendants rather than plaintiffs necessarily. Or plaintiffs, in my case, often defendants.
Yes.
So you left, but you then decided, well, suburban practice was not for Abe, and wanted to move into the city, I suspect. That's and you right. went to work at Carter Kapner in 2005. What prompted you to move? Because by that stage, I think you would have been there for nearly 5 years with Peter?
I was with Peter for 4 years, so I did my 2 years of articles of clerkship and then 2 years employment. And by that stage, I really decided that there were two reasons behind it. Well, there might have been three, actually. Financially, there was certainly one. I knew I would get a better income if I worked for a firm in the city. The second was, I think I, by that stage, really struggled with the travel from my parents' place and then from the rental place where I was at Toowong with the travel. Then also the stress if you had some urgent filing to do you'd have to travel from Mount Gravatt, and sometimes the documents are prepared at the, you know, they're not ready till, you know, 3:30, and you have to race into court. I think by then I'd started to think, why am I putting myself through that stress? And also my friends were all working in the city, and I'd have to drive in to the city after on a Friday, and it meant, of course, you know, you'd be responsible citizen and lawyer, of course, you wouldn't drink and drive. So I felt it was, and I was still young, so I felt it was time to move into the city. By that stage, I'd realised that I wanted to do personal injury and family law only. I didn't want to be doing anything else. And there was a position available at with Carter Kapner, who were at that time only a personal injury firm. But they had wanted to branch into family law. So there was an opportunity for me to continue working in personal injury, but to start and grow a family law practice there. And so that's when I decided, as difficult as it was telling Peter that I decided it was time to move into the city. And that's when I took a job with Carter Kapner in 2004, 2004.
So was there just the two of you out at Mount Gravatt, two lawyers, you and Peter?
It was Peter and I, and then Peter put on another article after I got admitted in 2002. So I think, yeah, it was 2002. So that's when I decided to, that was my reasoning behind moving. But yes, he put on an article, Clark, once I'd been admitted.
So, yeah. All right. So, but then you left Carter Kapner to go off to Slater and Gordon. I'm assuming that that was mainly because they were doing a lot of personal injuries work.
No, there was a partnership split. And the partner that I was working for at the time decided that he wanted to sell his interest in Carter Kapner and to pay him out. The personal injury practice was sold. So I had actually accepted a job at another firm, knowing all this was happening and not certain as to what my future was. And some of the others did the same. They went and left when they knew that there was not going to be a position for them, or were worried there wasn't going to be a position for them. So I actually was on the brink of accepting another job with another firm when the partner who I'd been working under and had told me that he wanted me to come with him, that he really valued my me as an employee, and he wanted me to come with him to Slater and Gordon. So that's how Slater and Gordon bought the files, and that's how I ended up at Slater and Gordon in 2008.
Oh, that's it. That was a bit unexpected, I would have thought.
It was. It came as a bit of joy. I was very happy at Carter Kapner. Mm-hmm. I was probably the happiest if I look back at my career, other than working for myself, I would say my 4 years at Carter Kapner were probably the happiest I had in a workplace. It was a great place to work. Working for Peter Carter, the principal, or the managing partner there. Peter's an excellent lawyer, and he's just an excellent business person as well. He's got a great mind, and working for Ian Brown, who was the partner I was working for at the time. Ian was an excellent lawyer, so I had excellent benefit of. The benefit of excellent lawyers working there, and I guess that's why it was probably easy for me to decide to go with Ian, because I had developed such a good relationship with him, and I knew he trusted me and knew I would continue to do a good job, and there were going to be opportunities perhaps at Slater and Gordon, so that's why I ended up there. But I as I said, I think the 4 years I had at Carter Kapner were definitely the happiest I had as in terms of being an employed solicitor.
So that was because you had good leadership, or was it also the type of work, or was it just
good leadership opportunity? And I got to start the family law practice. Good cases, existing cases to work on in personal injury. I got to learn a lot of how to develop a practice and marketing and strategies that Peter would come up with and Ian would come up with. To grow their practice. So I got to see all that and learn. But it was also just everyone there was really cool to work with.
Oh, it's a really nice place.
Yeah. I would say there's not one person there that I didn't enjoy working with, which is pretty rare in a workplace. And I think everyone got along. And we still have catch-ups every year, a couple of times a year. We have a Carter Kapner crew catch up lunch and
alumni or something.
Yeah, sort of like that. But
Why do you think? I mean, how did they build such a good team? Because it must be something special that you get those people together, no or few conflicts. Can you think of anything that might have been the magic sauce, as in how to build that sort of a team?
I think Peter and Ian were just really good at picking the right people. I think they just had a knack for it. I think they could see what people would bring to the table, so to speak. And perhaps we were all very relaxed and they could see that, much like them. They still, were very serious businessmen in terms of, but they didn't come across that way. And I think they looked for that in their staff. They looked for people who had drive, who were intelligent, friendly, and I think that's what they looked for, to make sure it fitted within the culture and of their practice.
So it's possibly more important not so much about your marks or your experiences to how you fit in. Because if you're a lawyer and you've graduated as a lawyer, you do, we hope that you have the intelligence to be a lawyer. Mm. So I do think that fit into a culture is really important. I would agree with that.
I think as well that I and the other solicitors that were in the firm, I think we all sort of had the common element of having a lot of just common sense, which some lawyers lack, and they just focus so much on the various sections and subsections of legislation, and it's like, well, there's also some practical things you've got to think about and just some common sense to apply to, you know, every case to the law and prior case, you know, precedent case law. There's also a need to have a lot of just common sense, and sometimes people focus so much on, oh, I need to know that, I need to know that case, and I need to know that piece of legislation. It's like, you also need to know your client really well as well, and how they're going to perform if a matter proceeds to trial, and also just understand costs and time and stress that people go under, and put that into the equation as well to determine, well, what's the best advice I really can give the client for their particular matter.
I think that's so true, and that's often what we were required to do, and what we should be doing is really saying, can you really put up with all this stress to perhaps get an outcome that might be years down the track? It's about how you build that relationship with clients and the rapport. I think it's just so important. But you left Slater and Gordon and went to McNamara's in 2012 and stayed there for 8 years. What kept you at the same law firm for 8 years?
So I knew the partners there from the Australian Lawyers Alliance. That's how I'd met them, and they had indicated they were looking to clear a staff member and bring someone on to take their role and to help grow their practice. They had a pretty healthy personal injury practice. I decided that was a good opportunity for me, that it was also a potential opportunity to, you know, to get to the partnership level. I knew that wasn't going to happen at Slater and Gordon. So at Slater and Gordon, they then bought Trilby Miso. Mm. And they brought a lot of those people in. That's when Ian decided to leave. He was understandably very unhappy with what had transpired. And it upset a lot of people at Slater and Gordon. Slater and Gordon, for the first at least 2 years that I was there, I would say had the best lawyers working there. But then the firm brought all these people in that upset a lot of the very senior experienced lawyers that were far more experienced than I, and not only Ian, but people like Margaret Brain. And these people were excellent lawyers, and it just upset them. And very soon people started leaving, including Ian, and I was one of the last left, actually, from a lot of the mergers that had occurred prior to Trilby Miso. And I just wasn't happy there. I just slowly just, my mind just drifted away, and eventually got to a point where I decided that I wanted to leave. And so having known the partners at McNamara Law through the Australian Lawyers Alliance, they indicated, oh, we might have a position available. Why don't you come over and we'll interview you? And I remember we had an interview over lunch at the somewhere on the river. I can't remember where, but yeah, and I just felt that there was an opportunity there to continue what I was doing, but also perhaps get to that partner level, which I never was going to get an opportunity at Slater and Gordon.
Yeah. So I want to pick up on two things that you just spoke about, because they're some of the things that interest me. And one is about, well, how important do you think as a young lawyer to get into those associations like the Australian Lawyers Alliance or the like, and to mingle with other lawyers in those sorts of in those sorts of groups? What can they bring to the table?
In terms of the Australian Lawyers Alliance, like when I was at Carter Capner, all the lawyers joined.
Mm.
Even some of the paralegals, I think, were members of the ALA. Peter and Peter was one of the, if not the founding, national president of the Australian Lawyers Alliance, and Ian also had been a national president, state president of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. So they, it was just an automatic thing with Carter Capner. Mm. You worked there, you joined the Australian Lawyers Alliance. So, you know, and they paid for it, and we'd go to conferences and they would pay for all that. And, yeah, you'd get to meet all the other personal injury lawyers, and some defendant lawyers would go as well. And they were, of course, ostracised over in one part of the room. No. But, yeah, no, that was just an automatic thing to as part of being part of Carter Capner, you join the ALA. But I certainly don't regret it. It's a great organisation, chanting the rights for those, you know, people who are disadvantaged or, you know, have a disability or are injured, and making sure they get access to justice. So I think that's, you know, it's excellent in terms of that, and it really does try and put forward as you know, to the state governments and to the national and to the Commonwealth government issues that it's finding. Yeah, with the law, and try and, you know, advocate for change. So it's a great network. You build up a great network, barristers, solicitors, etc. And that's where I think the real benefit comes from, not only just from advocating for those that are, shall we say, who are disadvantaged compared to us as lawyers generally.
Mm-hmm.
But also an opportunity to grow your own network.
Yeah, well, it's a great thing. In fact, I think before there was the Australian Lawyers Alliance, it was the Australian Plaintiff Lawyers Alliance.
That's right.
And I think, well, I was the joint recipient of their Civil Justice Award one year. So
there you are.
In the early 2000s. So, well, that's... when you were at Carter Capner, so what was it that kept you there for 8 years? Because back to that question, because that was quite a while you were there in the one firm. It's probably where you've been the longest.
So. That's right. I enjoyed it. There was good flexibility, particularly when I became a single father and I needed that flexibility. I enjoyed the work that I was getting. It was a good place to be, and like it was, I had to travel out to Springfield and sometimes to the Ipswich office, but mainly I was based at Springfield. But I guess I was well remunerated. Mm. Have, you know, forged some great work friends through that, and even get some of my referral work from people that I worked with there. I think it was just
the flexibility was one thing.
Flexibility was one thing. Mm. I just really enjoyed going to work there, and I think as well when, you know, I went through my separation at that time while I was there, and I think I just needed as well that, you know, that's solid employment. You know, needed that security of employment is what I'm trying to, what I'm saying. But so 8 years there and learnt a lot and was involved in a precedent case, which all lawyers want to be involved.
Yeah,
So that was a case called TRG and the Board of Trustees of the Brisbane Grammar School. So it involved an application to set aside a settlement agreement that had been reached when Shine Lawyers were acting for were going to do a class action for historically sex abused boys from the Brisbane Drama School, who had settled what we determined to be manifestly inadequate sums. This particular man got referred to me by a barrister by the name of Tim Ryan, and Tim had acted for TRG at the Commission of Inquiry into Historical Sex Abuse. And Tim felt that because I briefed Tim in personal injury matters over the years. His wife is Soraya Ryan, who of course is a judge. He felt I was thorough, and so it was really it's a great feeling to know a barrister felt you were the appropriate man to give it to, because he knew you did thorough work, that you'd do a good job, you'd look after him, you'd care about him. And so Tim's asked me to do it, and I did. I felt he was an excellent, deserving client. I feel very sorry that in the end it went all the way to the High Court. His application to set it aside was dismissed, and
but was after you left.
That was after I left the firm, so put it down to the, you know, if I'd still been on, maybe got over the line. But just a case where the legislation, I think, was poorly drafted, and the test was just simply going to be too high. We thought we thought we had the right elements for, you know, in terms of the case, that fit the elements for the test, but unfortunately the court didn't agree, and unfortunately, unless the government changes the wording of the legislation, I think it's really one of those pointless bits of law that we have.
And it's so sad, and it's one of the things that we always talk to our clients about, because we're often in the position of having to say the law is the law, it doesn't necessarily deliver justice. And that's probably one case again where the law just hasn't been able to deliver justice to TRG. But when you were with, I was just going to say, because Justice Ryan was, of course, at Legal Aid Queensland for quite a while too, so she has that legal aid connection. You were involved with the firm's Crossroads program. What was that?
So I came up with an idea of trying to educate children who were about to graduate from grade 12 and go to schoolies week of the decisions they're about to make, proceeding into their adulthood, and the consequences of those decisions. So the idea was to go to year 12 students just before schoolies week and give them some examples of people who have suffered as a result of the stupidity of others, or have made decisions from a criminal law point of view that would have, you know, long lasting effects on their future. So we decided to focus on two areas. The first would be on drink driving and the effects of drink and drug driving. And I had a client who I'd acted for actually at Slater and Gordon, and he agreed to come. He was catastrophically injured. Tragic set of circumstances. He was just off with his mate to get some fish and chips and snacks for their kids at the local store in Bouval, and a guy high on drugs and who had been drinking lost control. And my client, I acted for both his friend who'd remained in the car with his seatbelt on, but my client had gone into the little corner store to get the to get the food, had not quite got his seatbelt on, and this car hit them at about 170 kilometres an hour, and they were in a tiny car, and unfortunately one of them got wedged into the dashboard and in between the window and the dashboard, and suffered a T7 spinal cord injury and a minor head injury. His friend was injured, but not as badly, because he had his seatbelt on. And eventually I settled that case when I was still at Slater and Gordon. But I remained in contact with the client, and I approached him about coming to speak to kids. And it puts a face, and just, you know, rather than just telling them a story, I had the benefit of having him there to be able to tell, basically to interview him like we are now, about what happened, how it happened, how long he was in hospital for, the rehab he had to go through, the effect that it had on his family, and how he has to has had to adjust to being in a wheelchair. And I can assure you that a lot of grade 12s, they're getting excited by schoolies week. There was not one student in that room of, you know, a couple of hundred not captivated by the client's story, right? And they would come up at the end and shake his hand and stuff. And Tim Ryan, or if he wasn't available, another barrister would come along with criminal law experience and talk about the effects of the one punch law and things like that. And just telling them you're about to get into a situation where you're going to be potentially, you know, fueled by alcohol and in confrontational situations with other people. And it's just to remind them of what the, you know, what the laws are in relation to the one punch laws, but also, you know, what happens if you're caught drink driving, and those sorts of things. So, and how that can affect that criminal record can affect their future employability. So again, very educational. Their stories are a little bit more, shall we say, lighthearted.
Yeah.
And that included stories, cases they would tell of people they've acted for who've thought they've had consensual sex with someone at schoolies week or after alcohol, and it's turned out it's that the, you know, it actually constituted rape. So there were serious stories there to tell these kids so that they were able to think about that. If they got themselves in that situation, they can go, oh, hang on, before I get into this fight, I might just think about what that lawyer said about that bloke who was charged with, you know, with murder.
And why did you think about doing it? Like, I mean, it's a very admirable thing, and I've got some stories that I could tell you too about young lives ruined by things that they've done when they're young and regret, regret.
It was just wanting to make a difference. Yeah. I went in there thinking that if I made one child make a different decision than they were going to, had they not heard, you know, our presentation, then I had, you know, I'd done my job as a lawyer. I felt as though that was more important almost than the general legal advice I was giving on a day-to-day basis. I felt as though I was making a difference to society. Referring back to the TRG case, I felt I was going to hopefully make a difference to someone's life who'd clearly been, had not received a just and reasonable settlement. And I hoped to change that for him and get him fair compensation. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. But it was more driven by the desire to change someone's life rather than make money or whatever. The whole purpose of that case and cases like that that I've run and the Crossroads program to hopefully make one.
Has the firm still kept that up, do you know?
I'm not sure. It's something that I will endeavour to do again. And I still am in contact with that client, and I would like to think that he would come and do that with me. But yes, it's something that when I've got a bit more support that I would like to pick that up again.
So one of the things, I mean, as lawyers, we are often asked to do pro bono assistance, and this is one example of pro bono assistance that you're giving to younger people as a group. Do you think that's a better way to deliver pro bono assistance than helping on individual matters, or do you think that each plays its part?
Oh, I think each plays its part. You know, financially, a lot of people can't afford legal representation. And then I think also we have to have a side of being able to be out in the community and educating people about decisions and the, you know, the consequences of those decisions and how the effects their decisions might have, not only on, and in the case of this client, it wasn't just him. His marriage broke down. He can't play, you know, can't kick a ball with his son. He can't run around with his son. And then so it's like a domino effect. It just has an
effect. So he wasn't the young person. Was he the young person who was catastrophically injured?
He was in his 30s.
Yeah. But it was the driver of the other car that was the young person.
And he had a history. In fact, after the accident, he was charged, but then he fled to Victoria, and they had to track. They found him. There were warrants for him and that issued, and eventually got caught in Victoria. And he clearly hadn't learned.
No.
And perhaps maybe if he'd come and met Darren afterwards and his family and sat down with them, but I'm not sure whether or not that would have had any effect on this particular individual. I think you need to get to it beforehand, so before they go down that path, and that's why I thought grade 12s presents that great opportunity, because they are turning from boys to men, and they're about to go to school this week. So probably the first time they've really been away from their parents for a while with their friends, where alcohol, perhaps drugs, are accessible. And there's going to be times when they're going to be in situation, not all of them, but some of them, where they will have, they need to, hopefully, having heard our stories, will think perhaps maybe there's a better option.
I absolutely agree. I wish they would take more notice of their parents too when they tell them
that. Yeah, we'll see how I go with mine.
You've worked in personal injuries for many years now.
Mm-hmm.
How's the practice of law in this area changed in that period?
Look, I'm probably lucky. When I came into personal injury, the Civil Liability Act and all the Personal Injuries Proceedings Act and the Workers' Compensation and Rehabilitation Act had all just came into had all been just enacted. The Motor Accident Insurance Act had been around before that, but so I was lucky. I didn't sort of have to shift into suddenly learning new legislation, having been practicing other under different legislation enacted previously. So I was lucky in that regard, and the Civil Liability Act was the biggest change. In terms of other ways in which it's how I've had to adjust. I'd say, costs has become a big thing that people need to be very cautious, conscious about. Clients are more and more conscious about costs. The cost of living is going up for everybody. That doesn't mean lawyers shouldn't be able to charge reasonably for their services, but it's something that I think if you want to get a client if you want someone to be your client, you need to find ways that will, I guess, make your services more enticing, and your costs will therefore be more attractive to them. That's a big area for the challenges that we face, and that includes in personal injury. It's which I do it on a no win, no fee basis, like all the big firms and the other firms, the smaller firms that do personal injury. But it's coming up with a way to, I guess, make it more attractive to people to want to use your services. I think that's become a big challenge.
And how do you, because I recently spoke to someone who said that one of the things that he's been quite concerned about is how advertising has gone in the legal profession, because when he first started, you couldn't even mention where you worked or where you might have been located, because it was seen as going against the prohibition against advertising. So what do you see about that, the prohibition against advertising? How is it helpful and how is it not helpful?
Look, I think it's helpful in terms of trying to ensure that people are ethically, and they're not, shall we say, not unethically trying to entice people to bring claims that genuinely should not be brought. I think that the downside is that it makes it very difficult for people like me to compete with the likes of Shine, Slater and Gordon, etc., who have these huge budgets to be able to advertise, and compared to the little old me who's got very little advertising budget. So it makes it hard in that way, but I guess it also ensures that, when we are advertising, we're doing it within our ethical mindset that we should have. But as I said, it does make it hard competing against the bigger players with the bigger budgets.
Understandably. I suspect that working in personal injuries involves a lot of negotiation and mediation. What's your negotiation or mediation style, and which styles have you seen? It's a big question because I'm quite interested in myself. Which other negotiation styles have you seen that are not so useful?
I think you get some people who are very combative in their approach. I'm very relaxed in my approach to settlement conferences, so compulsory settlement conferences or mediation. I like to try and firstly acknowledge the aspects of the defendant's case, and accept if there are issues that they raise that are legitimate problems for my client's case, and then advocate for the better parts of the client's case. I don't see any point in shying away from issues in cases and trying to sugarcoat them. There's no point to that.
No.
Any lawyer will see through that. In family law, it's much the same. If you've got evidence about a particular that can supports your position, get the client to get it to you as soon as possible. You know, if they had an inheritance that was used to pay for a house, go and get all the documentation to show it and put the issue to bed as soon as possible. So I think when I'm negotiating, it's make sure that everything has been provided up front. That has to be provided. And I'm not in favour of people going on fishing expeditions for things that are irrelevant. That's just costly to people. But it's important, I think, to lay your cards on the table face up and be honest with your client and say, look, these are the issues you've got in your case. You need to accept those issues. We'll advocate for you on your good points. But, you know, when you're thinking about the matters, your matter and what result you want to achieve, don't forget these particular aspects of your case that aren't so positive. And I think that's probably it, but not, you know, I don't take a adversarial combative role. I just don't see how that's helpful to anybody. I think cards on the table, face up and accept the bad points and advocate your good points.
Move on. Do you have any resources that you have read or used to improve those negotiation skills in the past?
No, I think just learning from various barristers I brief is probably where I've learned the best techniques, and just, being in mediation and seeing how the mediators work as well, I think tends to give you the best practical experience on how to negotiate and how to achieve the best result for your client. I think in doing so, in the approach that I take, you're avoiding the possibility of escalating legal costs. But I haven't read any books on mediation or, you know, how to be a negotiator.
And not any courses.
Although one of my favourite movies is The Negotiator, but I haven't learned anything from that movie. But, yeah, there's no books I've read. Or it's been really just 20 years of,
practice. Yeah. So what happened in 2020 to make you leave McNamara's?
So COVID occurred. There'd been a couple of people laid off in the months before, and unfortunately, they made the decision to let me go. I had always thought about starting my own practice, but not in the middle of a pandemic. So it came as a bit of a shock to be let go at that time.
Can I just, I might just interrupt you, because you said that you went to McNamara's with a view to making it to partner. What do you think, because obviously you weren't a partner after 8 years, so Was that because of the way in which your life actually changed because you were now the, you know, you couldn't put as much time into the firm with being responsible for looking after two children, or what do you think might have?
No, it didn't have anything to do with the family issues. The opportunity just didn't eventuate.
Yeah.
To move into that role. But I was prepared to keep going and see, and look, I had the and then stable employment, and then I guess going through a divorce, you need that stable employment, that flexibility with young children. So I didn't want to upset the apple cart, so to speak. So I decided to not push the partnership aspect and just hoped it would eventually happen. I look back now and think it wouldn't have. And the reason for that being is that they already had a partner in personal injury. They probably would have been looking for someone to take a partnership role, perhaps who was in family law or wills and estates. So I'm not sure the opportunity was eventually was going to come anyway. But then COVID happened and my hand was forced anyway to and had, you know, I was let go. So not the greatest timing, because I knew that there might be difficult to obtain employment, although I did hope that with my level of experience and contacts that I'd be able to find a position. However, I soon found that either I was overqualified or the firms just weren't putting anyone on because they were just worried that there wasn't going to be, whilst they had enough work at that time, they were worried that with COVID there wasn't going to be new work coming into the level they needed to support someone on, you know, who is at my level, was not going to be, you know, was a senior lawyer. So they needed to, I guess, make sure they would have enough work to support someone with the salary that they were going to have to pay me. And those opportunities just weren't there. Firms just weren't prepared to take that risk on. And I remember there was one job that I applied for, and they were looking at giving me an interview, and then suddenly the recruitment agency said they pulled the job altogether.
And so how long were you looking then before you made the decision?
Probably about 2 months. By then I'd realised the pandemic wasn't going to be an overnight thing, that it was probably going to go on for a little while, and I decided that I need to find something, and it was sink or swim, really. So I decided to start my firm, and I immediately contacted, when I'd left McNamara's, I contacted anyone who was a direct referral source of mine to let them know I wasn't there anymore, and then told them that I decided to start my own practice. And before I knew it, a file was referred to me, and my first file was a public liability accident involving a manhole that dislodged when the client drove over it and it caused an accident. And I decided, let's run it. And
maybe one day you might be representing me, because I have a tendency to walk and read at the same time, and I've nearly fallen into a manhole.
I'm not sure. I think your contributory negligence is going to be very high in a case like that. So he got referred to me by someone that I'd worked with in the past, and then I got another one, and then someone who I'd done work for at another firm referred me a lady who'd had a workplace accident, and it just sort of suddenly one by one would come in. And once I had the website up and you know, did some Facebook and that, the family law started to come in, and I needed that because the personal injury work was all being done no win, no fee, so I knew I wasn't going to get paid for 18 months to 2 years at least. And I thought, right, I'm going to need some paying work to go. So that's why I jumped back into family law. And so that started to come in then. And so I started to get a bit more financial security, because I'd had to rely on JobKeeper initially, mm-hmm. even when I started the firm. JobSeeker, just to give me something financially to keep mm-hmm. going. And that continued for a little while as well because I wasn't earning any income really because everything was initially was personal mm-hmm. injury and it was no win, no mm-hmm. fees. I'm not getting paid anything. But slowly but surely working work picked up and JobKeeper wasn't needed anymore. And I was grateful to the clients in the personal injury that I acted for in personal injury, they agreed to fund their medical reports, which, you know, was yeah. really helpful. And they understood my circumstances. I told them that, you know, I'd been let go from secure employment and that I was now financially destitute, so to speak, and would need them to fund the outlays and look, they totally understood that given the fact that I wasn't getting paid for my time at that time yeah. so until the end. So yeah, I had a lot of understanding clients, a lot of patient clients in that time, and but nevertheless it was very stressful, like knowing that you didn't have potentially any work coming in, and sometimes you'd be twiddling your thumbs wondering where the next job would come from.
But you have a virtual office, don't you? So one of the benefits I suspect with COVID is that there's not that demand for face-to-face
offices. No. So, yeah, look, I can do a lot of consultations by Zoom, but I was still going and seeing clients yeah. at their house and socially distancing and all that, the COVID protocols and things like that. But clients have also found coming here quite comfortable. They don't feel uncomfortable about it. From my home office, they're very comfortable with that. I think the fact they don't have to drive in the city and park or battle city traffic, I think they love. I think a lot of people have started to realise the benefits of not having to travel into the city and going to smaller suburban offices. I do have the visited office, the virtual office in the city in the event that I need it. I certainly don't have any issue traveling to clients, or alternatively, they don't seem to have much issue coming here either.
I was going to ask you about doing a practice management course because you did that whilst you were at McNamara's. That was pretty fortuitous.
Look, in the end, it saved me a lot of money. That's right. They agreed to, because when we had discussions about becoming a partner, they said you need to do the PMC and... So I got that funded by the firm. It was great. Mm-hmm. It saved me several thousand dollars and time outside of having my own practice and having to take mm-hmm. time out, you know, take time off before I could have my own practice to do a course and so yeah, it was very fortuitous. Yeah.
And would you recommend somebody, like if people weren't necessarily thinking that they were going to make partner or run their own firm, is there a benefit in doing the practice management course?
Oh, absolutely. You get taught a lot. Yeah. Trust accounting. The trust account component's very important for any solicitor to know. It also helps with your marketing. You know, you do components of the course are about marketing and getting work and things like that. So definitely I strongly recommend that, even if it's not something they plan to do or that opportunity might not be available to them at that time, is to go and do it, because there are other benefits.
Yeah, for sure. So you've spoken about some of the challenges of starting your own business, such as getting clients, not working on no win, no fee. Were there any other particular challenges that spring to mind 2 years in?
Oh, look, having to do your own admin. so not having for at least 18 months, not having the financial resources to be able to put somebody on. Because it's a very serious obligation when you put someone on to work for you, because they've got a family and you don't want to be in a situation where you can't afford to pay for them and then you have to let them go or whatever. So I made sure the time was right. from two aspects. One, that I'd still been able to manage my file load without having somebody, but also knowing that financially it was also the right time to put someone on, and eventually I did. And then you sort of start to get some of your life back. So the other challenge is you become time poor for a while, because often I'd find that if my kids were here, I would have to work around them, put them to bed, and then come back and do another few hours worth of work, mm-hmm. because I might have picked them up from school, and therefore, you know, kids being kids, particularly at the age mine are, 11 and 7, that, you know, you do have to focus some attention on them. They want things done. They want dinner. They want to go outside. They want to jump in the pool, whatever. You're finishing your day a little bit early on those days, so then you've got to, you know, burn the midnight oil. So it is one of those things where that's a challenge. You become time poor, and then you get that relief of finally being able to put somebody on that they can do some of the things that, you know, the admin components and of your files and just some of the basic work that paralegals do in terms of, you know, making appointments with clients and getting briefs done and copying and scanning and all those things that are very time consuming, and you certainly can't charge at the hourly rate that, you know, I ordinarily charge for the advice work. So it's good. You're then saving, you're burning the candle at all hours of, you know, hours of the night. You start to get that back. So
is that one of the benefits, though, of having your own practice, is at least being able to have the flexibility to pick up your kids from school, take them to the things that they want to go to, and then working later if they're not there?
Absolutely, yes. You get that opportunity to start and finish when you want, because you know you've got your access to your office all the time, and the weekend if they're not here, and you know I can do things to in advance or catch up. So that is that flexibility is excellent. The downside, of course, is that you've got to find the work. You need the time to be able to find the work and go and market and things like that, which is very difficult when you're the receptionist, the secretary, your paralegal, and the lawyer at the same time. And you're not often getting paid for the things that they do, so ordinarily it would be their role. So that means that the hours you're actually billing are a lot less. But yes, you do get that flexibility to be able to knock off, and you don't have to put in a leave form to go and play golf if you want to go and play golf on a Wednesday afternoon. Or if you want to go, you know, to the coast for the week, I don't need much approval for that.
No.
Having said that, the laptop does travel with me, and the printer has as well at times. It does have that benefit.
So what sort of work are you undertaking now? It's mainly just in personal injuries and family.
Yeah, so the practice in personal injury is a various mixture of car accidents, workplace accidents, public liability and medical negligence, and then your family law for everything from, you know, financial matters, parenting matters. I also have done a couple of probate applications as well, because I did that a lot when I was with Peter. I did a lot of wills and estates. So I don't do wills and powers of attorney per se, but I've done probate applications for people I've met through local business networks who've just asked me if I could do it, and probably a little bit more affordable than some of the bigger firms that charge for doing probates. And so I've done a couple of those, and but primarily it's been personal injury and family law. And at the moment I'd say it's probably 60-40 personal injury, family law. Sometimes I help some people out with some debt collection if they want a letter of demand.
Here I am, talking about debt collection.
Yes, I do occasionally help people out with letters of demand and things like that. If provided it's within, you know, my knowledge and experience in the past. Otherwise, if it's, I don't want to be a jack of all trades, master of none. I don't want my people to see my firm that I'm doing all of this stuff. And ultimately, the transition for me will be to employ someone to do the family law and to get back into just solely doing personal injuries. But that's my little, my business plan, so to speak, is to move into small premises and have a couple of employees working from an office. But I want to make sure I've got the financial backing before I do that. And
I was going to ask you where you're going to next, but you've already answered it.
Yeah, so the next step is to move the office actually into a proper leased office space and somewhere in the suburbs. Mm. Won't be going to the city. I think clients prefer to be able to park without the expense.
I also think they think that losing an arm. They have more of a connection to someone that lives in their own community, and they don't think of you then as being somebody that's so far above them that you don't have as much of an understanding
of them and their problem, what they're going through. What they want. Yeah, so absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think being based in the community rather than in the city is better is better. And yes, you don't get that perception of being someone who's, my God, what are their hourly rates here at Waterfront Place? I'll be looking for something that's in a suburb that's within, you know, a few kilometres of the CBD so that it's still attractive for people from various walks of life in Brisbane to come to, but no intention of moving into the CBD. I would like to eventually move my practice to the Sunshine Coast or to have a practice both in the suburbs here and somewhere on the Sunshine Coast.
Why the Sunshine Coast?
I have a place up there, so and I love the beach. So, and I think Sunny Coast is a really nice family environment. It's good to raise kids up there. So, I've had a I probably enjoy the Sunshine Coast more than the Gold Coast. Mm. But maybe if success comes my way, that I could afford to have an office on the Gold Coast, I might. But I'm not sure. It'd be the Sunshine Coast first, but that's the plan. Something here and then something up there, and then move into retirement on the Sunny Coast
as quickly as possible. I was going to ask you, one of the things that I've noticed that's been threaded through your whole interview is your friendships that you've built and the relationships that you've built over many years, and how important you think that they've been for you and for you in your career, but also for your social life. I always like to ask this question: what's a really good tip for how you build really effective relationships? Because I hate the word networking. Everybody hates it, but yeah, so
relationships. Be yourself. Don't pretend to be someone you're not. Be prepared to be open and honest. Don't be afraid to tell people your life story. Don't be someone you're not, or try and fit into a group that you're not really meant to be part of. Like that's not really who you are, or your ethos, so to speak. It's be yourself and fit into the groups that you know have the similar attributes and ethos, values.
I was going to actually ask you about that, about being opened, because I hear that you were quite the hero when you were very young. So what was that story all about?
So when I was 10, my dad worked for a company called DuPont, and they used to have their annual Christmas, they'd have an annual, I think it was just a conference, but it wasn't really a conference. It was more just like a big Christmas getaway and all the staff and their families would be invited. And I remember one year we went to Hamilton Island and
there was... Wow, that's quite nice.
I know, yeah, they were pretty good. Hamilton, I remember Hayman Island and places like that and Cairns and that. So they were good holidays. And I remember there was a... everyone was accumulating around the pool. There's a rather large pool at the one of the what was the main hotel part of Hamilton Island, and there were drinks and food and stuff, and a lot of the adults by that stage had probably consumed way too much alcohol in the sun, and a toddler fell into the pool. And I just happened to be walking by, and it must have only happened a few seconds prior, thankfully, but because he was still floating to the bottom. And so I dove in, and I didn't have time to yell. I just out of instinct, I realized that, you know, if he's under for too long, his lungs will get filled with water and he'll drown. So I just jumped, dove straight in, pulled him up, and was holding him above the water, struggling myself because he was a big tiger, I remember. And so here I'm trying to hold him, and thankfully my sister saw me, and she jumped in and helped me to hold him up, and yeah, he had some water in his lungs, and he was breathing and that, and we sort of, I think in my action of holding him like this, some water had come out, it spewed out of his mouth so to speak as I was holding him across his chest, holding it, trying to keep him above the water, and I remember his parents were eternally grateful, and I got to meet him again when I was about eight. So I think I was about 18, and he would have been about 9 or 10, 11 by that stage. It was about that sort of age, and yeah, so I that was
that's wonderful.
That was it. I can't remember. It was somewhere like Airlie Beach or something. We were holidaying there, and so this boy's parents were still employed with Dupont as well, and I think I hadn't seen him for all that time, but yeah, we got reintroduced, and Dad and his parents told him the story and that, and yeah, I think he was pretty amazed. And then in my 30s, I think my son may have been born or was on the way at the time. My wife and I were driving back from northern New South Wales, and we'd stopped at Tagum, just on the Gold Coast Highway. It was a really hot day. I remember it being, must have been high 30s, early low 40s. It was a stinking hot day. And I'd noticed this car driving alongside us, and I was looking at it thinking, well, that's a bit weird. What's that? And it turned out it was a really old Ford Cortina or something like that. It had picked up a Hessian bag underneath, and it was dragging it on the highway, and the Hessian bag, because the friction and the heat of the tar, it caught fire, and they were heavy metal, you know, they were rockers, they were heavy metal kids, they would have been in their late teens, I reckon. They were headbanging to really loud music. They had no idea that the Hessian bag was starting to, was on fire, and it was starting to creep up underneath the car. And so when we stopped, I jumped out of the car just on instinct, and I opened up the door, and at this stage, the guy in the passenger side was horrified at what I was doing. And I don't think I had time to say anything, or if I did, they couldn't hear it over the music anyway. And I just leaned across and undid his seatbelt and sort of grabbed him in around his neck and shoulders and pulled him out, and grabbed his left arm and pulled him out. And at this stage, I think the driver was in shock, but thankfully a cabbie in the other lane had seen the same thing, and he jumped out and opened up the driver's door and was yeah, by this stage they'd realised someone was, I think someone else was screaming, the car's going to blow, and the bloke in the back seat, you know, he jumped out, I think, because I was pulling his mate out of the car. I think he probably thought it was on.
I'm going to beat him.
But they thought it was, you know, I was, you know, carjacking them probably. Anyway, I pulled them out, pulled them aside onto the road, and then they saw the fire building underneath the car, and probably within less than 30 seconds, the car had blown up. And, yeah, I'm hopeful to think they would have seen the smoke eventually and jumped out, but I couldn't take the chance because they were just headbanging. The music was so loud. Their hair was all over their face when they were stopped at the lights, and I just out of instinct thought, no, they're not going to know. And I just feared, I just had the sixth sense of fearing the worst, that the car was going to blow up, and ultimately it did. And I remember they were hugging me for ages on the side of the highway.
Well, I would be too.
So never got any bravery award for it, but didn't want one. You know, it was just right place, right time, I suppose. But I guess I look back now and think the car could have blown up while I was standing there, like anything could have happened.
Yeah.
But didn't have time to worry about that.
So you're the sort of person you'd want to have around in a crisis.
Yeah, I like to think I'm pretty cool when it comes to that. I knew what I had to do, and that was that there was no point yelling at them to get out. I had to take the action of actually opening the door and just leaning straight across him. And, yeah, naturally I've got some resistance, but I think adrenaline, you know, even though I wasn't the biggest guy, it's amazing with adrenaline, what strength you suddenly have. When he was on the road and I pulled him out, I think that's when he saw the Eschen bag and the flames, and that's when he went, oh, yeah.
I'm glad I'm out.
Yeah.
I think, Abe, that's a lovely spot to stop this interview, unless you wanted to add something as a final thing to say.
No, I think that probably covers everything.
Yeah, that's really lovely. Thank you, Abe, for sparing the time to talk to me. If you want to find out more about Abe, there are show notes with each of my episodes, including contact details for each of my guests on my website, www.lorettacreed.com. Alternatively, you can find Abe on Insta, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Aaron's Legal Solutions. Please drop me a line if you have any questions or know of someone who may be interested in being interviewed for this podcast. Until next time, bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.lorettacreed.com.